where we left off last time, that we talked last time about the normal cell cycle and the normal control of growth, with a few allusions to how cancer messes it up. And today I want to do it from the other side. I want to talk mostly about the normal, about how the cell cycle is disturbed and there is a lack of growth control in cancer. So one way to start with that is just to look at the normal cycle, which is to take the handout for today, 16A. And this has a cycle very similar to the one on the last handout, but with a slightly different emphasis. Last time we said there are two switches, one for going from G1 to S, and one for going from G2 to M. And in cancer, it is usually the G1S switch which is fouled up. So this handout emphasizes just the G1S switch. And we said last time that in order for the G1 to S transition to take place, stable cyclin-dependent kinase has to assemble with newly synthesized cyclin to form a complex. And then that complex has to be activated by appropriate modifications. So we'll just put modifications. So then we get an active complex. And now this is a kinase. So what it's going to do is phosphorylate proteins, either activating transcription factors or inactivating inhibitors. So as we had last time, you just add phosphate to the target proteins. What we're going to do this time is pay more attention to what the actual target proteins are, but not right away. Now, it indicates here what some of them are, and we'll return to that. But what happens to this complex? After it has done its thing and added phosphate to its target proteins, then it disassociates. I'm trying to figure out whether that's the tape recorder or the mic causing that. And I don't know. And so it dissociates, and the CDK, you remember, is stable and remains around till next time, but the cyclin is degraded. But although the CDK is stable, without its cyclin, it's inactive. So it's going to wait around, but it's not going to be used until the next time we get to the G1S transition. Now, this, of course, is just part of it. This is, once you have cyclin, how that leads to phosphorylations and triggering the next steps, which lead to S. But how do you get the cyclin? And that's where the things we talked about last time come in, the growth factors and the tyrosine receptor kinases. They're involved here. And we've summarized that on the bottom here, where it says that the growth factors combined with a tyrosine kinase receptor. I give up. I'm going to turn down the mic and see what happens. I don't think it's me. Well, we'll see. So what we have here is the tyrosine kinase cascade, or the MAP kinase cascade, which we've redrawn again for you on the bottom left. And this is where you activate adaptor proteins, which activate RAS, which activate the series of MAP kinases, which activates a transcription factor, which allows you to make cyclin. So this is the part. Which is in the little box on the left. Now, we said that in cancer cells, there's usually something wrong with this switch, so that the cell automatically goes from G1 to S and does not stop for the appropriate signal, which is normally a growth factor from the outside. So how could that happen? And as we explained last time, there are two possibilities here. All of these proteins that we've written here are required for the cell to go from one step to the next. But normally, they're not active until the appropriate time. CDK doesn't combine, isn't active if there is no cyclin. Cyclin isn't made if there's no growth factor, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this system can get stuck in the on position if one of these proteins is either overproduced when it shouldn't be, or there's too much of it, or it's stuck in the active position. And this is what we've called a stuck accelerator type mutation. And alternatively, which we'll explain in more detail in a minute, you can release an inhibitor. Now, it's not so obvious from this part that there are inhibitors involved here which block this process normally until the blockage is relieved. For example, if you look back at your handout, you see there's a protein here called RBE2F, which is actually two proteins associated with each other. RB actually blocks or inhibits E2F, which is a transcription factor. So that RB holds E2F in check until it's phosphorylated and things are ready to go. So to say this again, normally, what does it take to get RB out of the way? It has to be phosphorylated, which means there has to be a growth factor to trigger all of this. But if RB is taken out of here, what happens? If RB is not here to block things, then the active transcription factor just kicks in the rest of the cycle automatically, growth factor or no. Now, this is a kind of break failure mutation. The RB brake is released and fails, and therefore the car just goes. Now we want to look a little more closely at these two types of mutations or changes. If, for example, the tyrosine kinase receptor here is always active, then it will kick this process in all the time. The overactive version of the gene for the tyrosine kinase receptor is called an oncogene. Now, an oncogene is just an abnormal version of a normal gene. The normal gene codes for, say, tyrosine kinase receptor, or RAS, or some other protein in this sequence. And the normal version is called a proto-oncogene. This is normal. It makes some protein you need in order for the growth cycle process to go forward and for this control process to go. An oncogene is an overactive version of a proto-oncogene. So that when it codes for protein, what happens? So maybe here's our normal version. We've somehow changed it. So I'll just put an X in here to indicate that it's changed. And what happens? Either you make too much protein, or you make the protein at the wrong time. Or there's an alternative, which is you make the protein, but the protein itself is altered. Now let's think of an example of this. Suppose a cell turns on the gene for growth factor and makes its own growth factor. In that case, the growth factor is acting as an autocrine and stimulating itself. Normally, a cell is dependent on growth factor from its neighbors to combine to the receptor. Now, does this cell have the gene for the growth factor? Yes, it does, because cells have the genes for everything. But normally that gene is turned off. But if that gene is turned on, then the cell makes its growth factor itself. And the cell will stimulate itself and is no longer dependent on its neighbors. This whole process will be kicked in continuously, and the cell will grow continuously. Now, the normal version of the growth factor gene is a proto-oncogene. The version that is turned on when it shouldn't be is a proto-oncogene. What would be wrong with it? If this is the part that is transcribed, probably is this where the mutation or change should be? And the answer is no. In fact, that's okay for the other case. But for this case, what we probably have is a mutation in the regulatory region, in the enhancer, the proximal, or the distal regulatory region, so that this gene is transcribed when it should not be. Now, what about an altered protein version? How could you alter the protein so that, in fact, this would be stuck on? Well, if the tyrosine kinase receptor is stuck in a form so that it's always activated, growth factor is now irrelevant, and this system is on. Alternatively, remember we said last time that many cancers have mutated RAS. RAS is part of this sequence, what's in the little box. If RAS is supposed to be activated only when growth factor kicks in the process, if RAS is stuck in the permanently activated form, then, again, this system is an override. So here, the protein itself is altered, and the mutation affects the coding portion of the gene. So what we've said is one kind of change that can cause cancer is to convert a proto-oncogene into an oncogene. But there's the other way of doing it. What about the break failure part? There are these genes and proteins like RB whose job it is to inhibit the process until it's time. These genes and their proteins are called tumor suppressors. That is, what the job of these proteins is to keep growth under control. And if you knock these genes and their proteins out, then control goes uninhibited. RB is one of the classic examples of this. It has its name. It was discovered because people who have retinoblastoma, which is a childhood cancer, people who have retinoblastoma were discovered to have in their tumors both copies of RB knocked out. So they had no RB in their cells of their eye. Certain cells of the eye had no RB protein. And as a result, those cells grew uncontrollably and formed a tumor. The other famous tumor suppressor actually acts here, and it's called P53. P53 is sometimes called the guardian of the genome. Because what it does is to block modification if the cell is damaged. If there is something wrong with the DNA, or if the chromosomes aren't aligned properly, or something is wrong, that activates P53, which blocks the activation of the kinase, which blocks further steps. Now, P53 is called the guardian of the genome because what it does is to prevent mistakes from being propagated. If there is a mistake, the cell, P53 causes the cell to slow down and either fix it or die. In the absence of P53, mistakes get through, and sooner or later, one of them causes cancer. Without P-53, the guard is off duty, the door is open, and your valuables are going to get stolen or messed up. And we'll talk a little bit later in more detail about how P-53, RB, and E-2F are involved here. What I want to do first is consider, how do you get the changes that cause cancer? How do you convert a proto-oncogene into oncogene or knock out a tumor suppressor? Now, the usual answer is that it happens by somatic mutation. When we think about mutation, we think about changing your DNA so that the DNA of all of your offspring are changed. Now, if that's going to happen, it means the change must be in your germ cells. The change must occur in the DNA of the eggs or sperm or the cells that give rise to them. Those mistakes are passed on generation after generation. But what if a mistake occurs in a skin cell or an eye cell or a liver cell? Will that mutation be passed on to the next generation? It can't. But what that mutation can do, and that's called somatic mutation, because one of your somatic cells has had a problem with DNA replication, etc. That kind of mistake affects that cell, and if that cell divides, it affects the lump of cells or the clone that come from that cell. And it can cause a tumor. So somatic mutation, mistakes in DNA replication, distribution of chromosomes, etc., in somatic cells is largely what leads to tumors. What kind of mistakes can you get? Well, you can get the kind we just discussed here. You can get a mistake in a regulatory region so that a protein is made in the wrong amount or the wrong time. And you can get a mistake in the transcribed region so that the protein itself is altered. There are two kinds of changes you can get that are important here. One is the kind I've drawn, that you change a base or two, and as a result, you change the functioning of the DNA. But another possibility is rearrangements. Sometimes DNA molecules get rearranged as a result of mistakes in repair. Here it's probably not mistakes in crossing over because these are somatic cells. But accidentally, the chromosomes get rearranged. You either have large deletions, large insertions, or translocations where a piece of one chromosome gets attached to another. And those kinds of rearrangements can cause you to have a coding region in which half came from one gene and half came from another. And this can cause cancer because the protein now is a chimeric protein. Half coded for by what used to be one gene and half coded for by another gene. And there are cases where you get a receptor tyrosine kinase that is chimeric and that is no longer regulated properly. And so it is always active. And this is what happens in CML. Chronic myelogenous leukemia is usually caused by this kind of mutation. Now, on the other hand, Burkitt's lymphoma is caused by a change in regulation. It is a rearrangement so that you put the wrong enhancer next to the wrong gene. A proto-oncogene has some regulatory sequence which turns it on at the appropriate time. If due to a rearrangement, we change and we put a new enhancer here that belonged to a gene that was on all the time, then what used to be our proto-oncogene is turned into an oncogene. Because now this gene has an active enhancer, a more active enhancer will be transcribed and translated more often, and you make more of the protein. And Burkitt's lymphoma is an example of that. Now, what other kind of changes can occur in a body cell, a somatic cell, that can cause it to lose growth control? How else could you mess up the DNA? One way of messing up the DNA is mistakes in replication, transmission, etc. It's an internal problem. The cell misfires. But another possibility is sometimes viral infection can have the same effect. Most cancers, we think, are not caused by viruses. But there are a few cases where we know that a virus can cause cancer, and there are a few cancers that are almost always associated with viral infection. Now, how does a virus get into the act? Here's the normal DNA. Here's the viral DNA. The viral DNA integrates into the host by a crossing over event, much like lysogeny in bacteria. So now you end up with a DNA where this part here, the straight part, originally belonged to the host, but the little circle came from the virus. So the virus has integrated, and we now have a continual DNA. Well, how could this cause cancer? Consider there's some gene here. The virus landed in the middle of the gene, and it causes the cell to lose control of growth. What could this gene have coded for in the first place? So think about that for 30 seconds. What could this have coded for in the first place? So that when the virus landed in it, we lost growth control. We can perhaps put it another way. Would you call this gene a tumor suppressor or a proto-oncogene? So you get about 15 seconds to think about that. And I think this time I'll call on somebody. But let me ask a question first. When this virus lands in the middle of a gene of the transcribed proportion, what's likely to happen to this gene? Turn on or turn off? This is likely to be turned off in the sense that we've ruined this gene by putting a piece of junk in the middle of it. So we've basically ruined this gene. We've knocked it out. And now the cell grows uncontrollably. So what was that gene? It was a tumor suppressor. So this was one of those, this gene coded for a protein like P53 or RB that holds things up, and that gene has been wiped out. So that's one way you can do it. You can inactivate a tumor suppressor. Now, is there anything else? Remember, viruses don't necessarily land in the middle of a gene. What if they had landed out here? What could that have done? Suppose this virus has an enhancer of its own genes. Now, that enhancer will be next to the gene where it landed. And that may turn on this gene of the host because a new enhancer has been added next to the gene of the host. If we add an enhancer here and the cell loses growth control, what do you call this gene? What do you call the normal version of it? This is a proto-oncogene which has been turned into an oncogene by adding an enhancer that overdoes it. Now, there's one other possibility. Yes?
How likely is it that the viral DNA is going to contain...
How likely is it that the viral DNA is going to contain an enhancer? It's actually extraordinarily likely because a virus has its own genes for its own proteins which have to be made in order for it to take over the cell. So it's going to have enhancers for its own genes in order to make its own proteins. Now, you brought up, though, an important question, which is, all of these things seem sort of unlikely. The virus lands in just the right place, etc. Why do these things happen? We think that viruses integrate all over the place. But what if the virus lands in a gene that's essential for, say, DNA replication? What happens to the cell? Kaput. You don't get cancer, you get dead cell. Goodbye. Too bad, but one cell lost, big deal. However, what if it lands such as to cause the cell to lose growth control? That cell will now grow at the expense of its neighbors. Unfortunately, the human body provides a selective system for the growth of cells without growth control. That we essentially select for the cells that outgrow their neighbors, which is good for the cancer cells and bad for us. So the rare mutations that happen to convert proto-oncogenes into oncogenes or knock out tumor suppressors, the cell in which that happened is essentially selected and outgrows others. And in fact, we know that what tends to happen is the cell gets one mutation, which allows it to outgrow its others. Then one of those gets another mutation, and if that allows it to grow even better, that cell is selected over all the others. So that cancer cells with time become more and more aggressive and have more and more mutations. Yes? When a cell is divided, does it replicate the viral DNA along with itself? If the viral DNA is part of the host DNA, yes. So a DNA replication origin will just start here and go all the way across. So this will be passed on like a gene at mitosis. Okay, so you could inactivate a tumor suppressor. You could enhance a proto-oncogene. And you can actually do one more thing, which is important, which is the virus itself can contain a gene that makes a protein that that helps the host grow. After all, it may be to the virus's advantage, or the virus may have been selected for its ability to cause its host to grow. So the virus could carry an oncogene. Or it can carry an inhibitor, that is, the gene for an inhibitor of a tumor suppressor. This is what HPV does. HPV has, this is a human papillomavirus, is much in the news because strains of HPV cause cervical cancer. The virus itself is not sufficient to cause cervical cancer, but appears to be necessary. When there is cervical cancer, you always find the virus. But when you find the virus, you don't always find cervical cancer. So when a vaccine has just been discovered, has just been approved, which in fact prevents replication of most of the strains of HPV that cause cervical cancer. And the way HPV operates is several of its genes code for proteins that inhibit P53 and RB. So the virus inhibits the inhibitors of cell growth, and then the infected cell grows carrying the HPV. Now, as you probably know, there has been controversy about this vaccine for this virus because this virus is transmitted only sexually. And the question is, should you in fact vaccinate people? Is that encouraging bad sexual behavior, and or is it unnecessary? And the governor of Texas, I believe, ordered that the schools should, in fact, vaccinate young girls. The best time to do it is before a person could possibly be exposed. And the thought is that he did it as executive order so nobody would have to vote on it. Yeah?
Is it possible for viruses to add to germ cells?
Is it possible for viruses to add to germ cells? Yes, it is. And if they do, then they will be inherited. They will be transmitted, as they say, vertically and not horizontally. And that there are cases like that of viruses which are passed in the germline from one generation to another. They're relatively few, but there are some. They are not thought to cause any human cancers that I know of. Well, okay. There's one caveat here. Now, let me just repeat that most cancers are not thought to be caused by viruses. Most of them are thought to be caused by some sort of random hit somatic mutation. But you've raised the question of, can you inherit cancer? And generally the answer is no, but you can inherit a predisposition to cancer. Now, how is that possible? These somatic mutations are mistakes in DNA replication and repair. What if you have a problem with accurate DNA replication or repair? That increases the chance that you will get a mutation in an oncogene, proto-oncogene, or a tumor suppressor and develop cancer. So people who have mutations that affect DNA replication and repair, so the mutation causes these either not to happen or to be inaccurate, those people are at much higher risk of developing cancer than the average person. Because the chance that this person will develop a somatic mutation in all of the genes is higher, and therefore the chance that they will happen to hit the wrong gene is higher than for average. Now, another kind of predisposition to cancer you can inherit is if you inherit a mutated tumor suppressor gene. Now, the way this happens is that you inherit one copy of the mutated gene. So most of your cells are fine, because most of your cells have one good copy of the gene, and that makes the tumor suppressor, and this cell grows normally. But the chance is now higher that you will develop cancer. And the reason for that is what's called the two-hit hypothesis. If you start out with two normal copies of the gene, how many hits does that cell have to take to lose growth control? Two. Mutation is random, but it's rare, and the chance that you'll get two rare hits in the same gene in the same cell is very low. So people who start out with two good copies don't usually develop develop cancer due to loss of tumor suppressor. But what if you start out with one copy already defunct? Now all it requires is one hit in this gene, and you will lose all ability to make tumor suppressor in this cell. So people who are heterozygous for a mutant tumor suppressor have, in fact, a higher incidence of developing cancer. And the RB gene was discovered, as I said, in people who get retinoblastoma. They get childhood eye tumors. And what happens is if you look at the eye tumor, in most of the cells of that person, the DNA looks like this. One good copy, one bad. But in the cells of the tumor, what do you think the DNA looks like? Double hit. Both copies have been hit and wiped out, and the person is not able to make the tumor suppressor. Now, let me just say, repeat before we said that tumors tend to progress. They tend to acquire more and more mutations as the cells grow. That's one of the reasons it's better to get them early, when there's less wrong with them and they're less aggressive. And most cancer cells have more than one mutation. So they have both lack of function mutations, tumor suppressors wiped out, and they have gain of function mutations. Proto-oncogenes have been turned on to oncogenes. Now, for a tumor to really cause damage, the cells must be able to leave their original site and metastasize or move to other parts of the body and establish themselves there. And that requires additional features, not just that the cell has lost growth control, but the cell is able to develop a blood supply. And so, in terms of treating cancer, One way has been to try and find out which part of this scheme is broken and fix it or overcome it. And the other way has been to try and block the tumor from getting a blood supply. And that's described in the articles, and we'll talk about it a little bit more in a minute. But before we do that, I want to come back and look at the details of how P53 and RB act as tumor suppressors. And we're going to start with RB and E2F. Now you want to look back at 16A. You want to look at the bottom. In a way, it's easier to do this backwards. E2F is a transcription factor. And once it is active as a result of this entire series of events, then E2F, being a transcription factor, binds to DNA, causes transcription of message, that gets translated to make protein, and these are the proteins that you need in order to actually pull off S. These are the histones, the enzymes of DNA replication, etc. Under what area does RB fit in? RB is complexed to E2F. And the combination is inactive. E2F is active. So in the absence of a signal, E2F is sequestered by RB, and E2F can't do anything, and you don't make the enzymes and stuff for DNA replication. But if a growth factor comes along, binds to its receptor, triggers the cascade, and you make cyclin, then the cyclin forms a complex that gets activated, and it phosphorylates RB. So if RB is phosphorylated, and that requires the start kinase, otherwise known as the active complex here of CDK and cyclin, and of course it requires ATP, which we haven't written here, you phosphorylate the RB and push it out of the way, and now E2F can do its thing, act as a transcription factor, and you can make the stuff you need to carry out S. Now, of course, what's going to happen after a while is we're going to take the phosphate off, RB is going to bind back to the E2F and turn it off. So what happens if RB is out of commission? If RB is out of commission, then the E2F is always active. There's nobody to stop it. And E2F then goes, binds to DNA, and you can make the enzymes any time to carry out S, whether you're supposed to or not. Now, what about P53? Let me just say before I leave this that analyzing retinoblastoma cells led to the discovery of RB and to its partner, E2F, which is a member of a class of very important transcription factors. Now, what about P53? P53 is the most commonly mutated gene in cancers. And we've said that P53 is the guardian of the genome, and that it acts at this stage. P53 is an unstable protein. It is made all the time. But under normal conditions, if everything is okay, the P53 is degraded and doesn't do anything. But if there is damage to the cell, specifically to the DNA, but there are many other damage signals that impinge on P53, if there is damage to the cell, then P53 is activated. More exactly, it is stabilized. So if P53 is stabilized, then it piles up. And when it piles up, it inhibits some of this modification steps. And so what happens is you can make the cyclin CDK complex, but it doesn't work. Now, P53 holds things up two ways. P53 holds the cell up temporarily. So when P53 goes up, when it's stabilized by damage, you get a rest in the cell cycle. So the cell sits at the G1S border and doesn't go anywhere. And presumably what happens is an attempt to fix whatever was wrong. If there is something big screw up in the DNA, the enzymes fix it. If everything gets fixed, then P53 signal, there's damage, goes away. P53 is no longer stabilized, it's degraded, and now there's no block and the cycle continues. But what if the damage is so bad it cannot be repaired? If the damage is really bad, then it causes cell death. Did we talk about the two kinds of cell death before? Cells can die in two ways. One is called necrosis. And in that case, the cell basically explodes, spews all of its garbage all over the place, and damages its neighbors. In apoptosis, the cell basically commits suicide. Using specific proteins, it digests itself and basically shrivels up and goes away. And this is what happens in response to P53. Now, this happens during normal development. The reason you have fingers and not a webbed hand like a duck is because these cells died by apoptosis. That's what happens to a tadpole's tail, etc. The cells basically digest their parts and they're reused by other cells without damage to the neighbor. So apoptosis is very important in development, and it's also very important in taking damaged cells out. And P53 is what triggers that. Now, as we mentioned earlier, what happens if you get rid of P53 is you have no screen, no guardian. People make knockout mice that by genetic manipulations are missing a gene. So people made knockout mice in which both copies of P53 were missing. Well, the mice were born and they scrambled around and they looked completely normal. At which point everybody thought, oh no. But then, at a very young age, they started to die of cancer because they had no guardian of their genome. When mutations occurred in these mice, the cells were not arrested or killed. The cells just went on growing. And eventually, some of those cells acquired the mutations to become tumor cells to grow indiscriminately and kill off the mice. So this gene itself is not needed for anything. This protein. This protein is like the guard in the door. Theoretically, you don't need it. Everybody's peaceful, right? Law-abiding, no problem. You don't need the guard. But if you have no guard and you leave the door open, what do you think happens? Things get broken. And that's exactly what happens here. Without P53 on the job, mutations pile up. Now, we mentioned trying to treat cancer. How do you do that? Well, now we know what the basic problem is that the cell is going from G1 to S when it shouldn't. So the classical way of treating cancer is when you find a lump of cancer cells, you remove them surgically, and then you try and kill the cells that are left. Now, how is a cancer, average cancer cell different from your average body cell? The average cancer cell is dividing, right? Your average body cell isn't. Some of your body cells are, but your average one is specialized and sitting around doing its thing. So the idea is using either chemicals or radiation that kill dividing cells preferentially, you hope to wipe out the cancer cell without killing the host. Now this is an iffy business, because you have to get the dose just right. And you probably all know that people who are treated with chemotherapy and radiation tend to get nausea, their hair falls out, etc. And that's because what are the cells that are growing? The cells that make your hair, the cells that line your gut are actively growing and they go too. Now with luck, they grow back and the cancer cells don't. Everybody would like to do something a little more subtle. And from studying cancer cells and the control of growth, we now realize that at least in some cases, you can do something more subtle. And one of the major things you can do is to block this. We know that in some cancers, what is wrong is the tyrosine kinase receptor is locked into the active form. So if we can inhibit this receptor, we're in gravy. And we've been able to do that in CML using the compound Gleevec. This compound is a small molecule that combines with a subclass of tyrosine kinase receptors and knocks them out. It inhibits them so they no longer send a signal. And this has been very, very effective in the cancers which have a defective tyrosine kinase receptor, and it binds to them. This is a small molecule inhibitor, and people are hoping to make more of the same. It's much easier to treat somebody with a small molecule than with a protein, because most of the other anti-cancer agents are antibodies. They are what is called monoclonal antibodies. When you stick an antigen into somebody and the person makes antibody, they make a mixture of antibodies. Those are called polyclonal. By genetic engineering, you can basically take one cell making one kind of antibody and get it to grow and make lots of antibody. So these special antibodies are not a mixture, but all the antibodies are the same. And the antibodies are either directed to a growth factor or a growth factor receptor. And they block one or the other. Now, you've probably heard of Erbitux. Erbitux is what got Martha Stewart thrown into jail. Erbitux, Iressa, and Herceptin are all antibodies that bind with different tyrosine kinase receptors. And it's written, the details are in your notes and they're in the article. And they work fairly well, but the problem is they're extraordinarily expensive. They're even more expensive than replacing the missing enzyme in glucocerebrosidase in Gaucher's disease. Except that goes on for years, and this unfortunately only goes on for months. But they're still extremely expensive, and also they have to be injected. They're proteins, and they have to get where they're going, and they often have side effects. But people think this is just the beginning of a new wave of drugs, of antibodies, which will wipe out some stage in this process. You can see that it's easier to knock out an oncogene protein than it is to revive a tumor suppressor. Now, Avastin is also an antibody, and it uses a technique we mentioned earlier that instead of trying to target the tumor cell, you target its blood supply. And what Avastin is also an antibody to a growth factor which is used by a developing blood supply, and it prevents the tumor from developing blood vessels that feed it. Well, Avastin targets VEGF, which is a growth factor, which is needed for new blood vessels to grow. And the tumor is sending out signals to attract new blood vessels. In the rest of your body, most of the blood vessels are already there. Okay, so it, I think, doesn't affect in any way blood vessels that you already have, just newly growing ones. And as we said, we think this is the tip of the iceberg. We hope to develop many, many more drugs of this kind. And people have just started to do screening in which you, for each individual person with cancer, you try and figure out where is this screwed up and therefore intelligently what to do. Now, this is basically what I wanted to say about cancer. So let me answer some questions and then we'll go on to the next subject. Yeah. How do you inherit a predisposition for a certain type of cancer? It depends which of, say, of your tumor suppressor genes are defective, which type of cancer you are prone to getting, for example. Also, I think if you have certain kinds of repair problems, there are certain kinds of cells which reproduce more and copy their DNA more and are more subject to repair. And so those kinds of cells tend to cause cancer. Why defects in RB cause specifically eye tumors and not something else is not clear. So if these people have the eye tumors removed and they live longer, eventually they usually develop ovarian cancer. But apparently this RB, this particular protein, is only used big time in certain cell types, and those are the ones that cause a problem. Yeah? Can any virus infect any cell? Well, the answer, first of all, is no. A virus has to actually match the surface of the cell in order to get into that cell. So each virus has a subset of cells which it infects. The reason that the flu virus, the cold viruses are not so dangerous, and polio is what cells they attach to. They're very similar viruses. But if they attach to your nerve cells, it's very different than if they attach to your nose cells. In addition to that, once they get inside your cells, many viruses cannot add their DNA to your DNA. Only subsets of viruses can do that. Yeah?
How come some people have a virus, like for example, HPV? Some people have it for a lifetime, and sometimes it goes away.
Well, this whole question of why doesn't everybody or nobody who gets HPV get cervical cancer, warts, etc.? And nobody really knows the answer to that. Clearly, HPV starts something, but it by itself is not sufficient. And what those other things are, we just don't know. But that's the kind of thing that people are working on, because not everybody who has HPV is at risk for cancer, and it would be nice to know who is and who isn't and how to tell. Yeah. The question of how do tumors induced by UV, how do they work? I don't know if they involve P53 or not, but as we said, I think the majority of tumors have mutations in P53. The way irradiation causes what are called thymine dimers. They cause adjacent T's in a chain to get hooked to each other, and that causes mistakes in DNA replication. And presumably, if your P53 is working, it's more likely to screen those out, and they're less likely to be maintained. Now, I want to shift gears considerably and talk about hormones. You could say that this subject is really about paracrines, because the issue here is a growth factor, which is usually a paracrine, triggers this whole process. The exception is when a cell makes its own growth factor, then it's acting as an autocrine. But hormones are endocrines. Paracrines are made by a cell and released by any old cell, and they're released in their own environment, and they affect their neighbors. But endocrines are made by specialized cells and go through the blood to distant targets. And I want to talk today, for the rest of today, about endocrines. Now, you can classify hormones many different ways. You can classify them by what their chemical nature is, or you can classify them by what they do, or you can classify them by what the target cells are, or what kind of signaling they use, etc., etc., etc. And we're going to talk about two of those aspects today. In your notes for reference is a table of the a discussion of the various properties you can use to keep the hormones straight if you want to, but that's at the end of your notes, and we're not going to talk about that. I want to consider first, what are the basic classes of things that hormones take care of or manage? And one of them, which is very important to college students, is stress. That stress, responses to stress are largely controlled by two hormones, cortisol, which is a steroid, and epinephrine, aka adrenaline, which we talked about before. Epinephrine essentially governs the short-term response to stress, and cortisol the response to long-term or chronic stress. Now, in addition, so they affect things like heart rate, blood pressure, things like that, and they also affect inflammation. Inflammation is a local response to injury, which is unpleasant at the time, but usually leads to healing. However, if you are facing a pop quiz, or worse yet, a real exam, or the MCAT, or something really serious, inflammation healing can wait. And so it turns out that cortisol interferes with and blocks inflammation, and that's why it's used. Cortisol and its relatives are used to treat and to subdue inflammation, and also to some, and the immune system in general. Now, clearly you can overdo it, but for a short term, it's a good thing. Now, another thing is the maintenance of what is called homeostasis. I think we mentioned this before, that your body maintains a more or less constant internal milieu or internal environment. You don't keep the glucose level in your blood exactly steady, but you keep it approximately the same. If the glucose level gets too high, you take corrective measures and lower it. If the glucose level in your blood gets too low, you take corrective measures and raise it. Maintaining things at about the same level is called homeostasis. And in many cases, it works as I described, that you have two factors, one that raises something, one that lowers them. You have an air conditioner and a heater, and between the two of them, you keep levels within normal bounds. In the case of glucose levels in the blood, the hormones that do it are insulin, which lowers the levels, and glucagon, which raises them. And we'll talk about how they work probably next time. Now, another thing that hormones take care of is what are considered periodic or episodic events. Now, in a short term, an obvious one is eating. You don't have an input of glucose and food, which is constant. You eat a few times a day, and there's a big bolus of food, and then you go without for a long time. And yet, the idea is to maintain a constant, relatively constant internal environment. So this is the level inside is maintained in spite of bursts of input, in part by insulin and glucagon. Now, I've deliberately written the same hormone twice to imply that depending on how you look at it, the job of a hormone can be multiple to do many different things. But when we think of periodic and episodic events, we usually don't think of eating. We think of things like menstruation and pregnancy and puberty and things like that. And those also are widely controlled by hormones. Pregnancy, for example, by sexual development by estrogen and prolactin, oxytocin, etc. Oxytocin affects the contractions both of the uterus and of the breast. Estrogen, many different factors, as we explained earlier, estrogen often affects the production of receptors for other hormones, such as oxytocin. Now, I realize that stress, in a way, would fit into this, but it's usually considered separately. And the final thing is overall growth. There are a bunch of hormones which act as growth factors. Most growth factors are not endocrines. Most growth factors are paracrines. But there are a few hormones that are made and act to stimulate growth all over. And you can also, there are also a series of what are called tropic hormones. And these are important because their job is to control the growth of glands that produce other hormones. And we'll get some examples of these today and tomorrow. So these control the growth of other glands. So one gland makes it, it goes to gland 2, and it affects the growth and effects and actions of gland 2. So this covers most of it. There are other ways of categorizing what hormones do, but this covers most of their jobs. And what I want to do for the remainder of the time is to look at it from another angle. What are the major hormone-producing glands, and what are the major hormone players? And that's on 16B. Now, I just want to say a word about the handouts. When you do the problems about the cell cycle, you should be able to do them with 16A in front of you. You don't have to memorize all the details. If you had 16A without any annotations, could you do it? You're okay. For when it comes to hormones, it is usually useful to memorize most of 16B. Because you have to keep sort of straight what the major players are. The fine points you don't need. But it seems to help a lot if you know about these hormones and these glands and who's connected to whom. And it will become much clearer as we go how these fit together, and it'll be much easier to keep in your head. Now, you see on this picture that a lot of the glands in hormones are all related to each other. There are arrows connecting them. And that includes the hypothalamus, or the HT, which is actually part of the brain, which is sort of the top dog here. And it influences both the posterior pituitary and the anterior pituitary, which are usually called the AP and the PP. They have other names as well. Now, the connections between the hypothalamus and these two parts of the pituitary are extremely different structurally. And maybe we should just go right to that. If you look at the picture in the little box on the bottom, these two parts are actually connected physically. So we've drawn them sort of like this. The anterior pituitary is more forward in the body, and the posterior more behind. Now, these happen to be next to each other, but they have totally different origins developmentally, and they serve different functions. This is from epithelial tissue, which is what virtually all glands are. And this one is really neural tissue. It's really nerves. Now, if you put here's the brain, sort of, and the hypothalamus, here's the hypothalamus, which is part of the brain, and there are much, much better pictures in your book, and you should realize that, strictly speaking, there's a connection here. There is no space. But we put a space here to make it clear what's going on. That there are cells here, cell bodies in the hypothalamus that synthesize hormones. How do those hormones get to the respective parts of the pituitary? You see that if you look on the left case, these cell bodies have nerve endings which are inside the hypothalamus. So the signal molecules which they make and release are released into the blood and travel through the blood to the anterior pituitary. This is the standard way hormones work. They're released into the blood, travel through the blood to their target. What is unusual here is that they're going directly from one organ to another organ. To understand how unusual that is, we have to think for a minute about how the circulation generally works. Generally, you have an artery, a blood vessel, coming from the heart, And when it gets to an organ, it branches, and you form capillaries, which form what is called a capillary bed. These are very fine blood vessels, and things easily get in and out of them. And the other half of the capillary bed picks up the blood, carries it into a vein, back to the heart. Now, suppose you have a second organ. How does the blood get to it? It doesn't go in series, it goes in parallel. So another artery goes to another capillary bed in another organ, which goes to a vein. So this would be one organ, and this would be another. These would be different tissues or organs, like the heart and the liver. The blood flows through each of them. How do you get blood from one to the other? If you're a blood cell, and you want to go from the liver to the heart, let's say from the liver to the lung, you have to, if you want to go from one to the other, you have to go all the way around the general circulation and take the other branch. Normally, you can't go from one organ to another. But there are a few blood vessels which act as short circuits to go from one tissue directly to another. And they connect two capillary beds so that you can look at them as going this way, or you can think of it as there's a capillary bed. And there's another one. This would be the artery. This would be the vein. This should go back to the general circulation, but it doesn't. It goes to another capillary bed. So you have two capillary beds in series with a joining vessel between them. And that's very unusual. And that's what you have here. And this is called a portal vessel. So the regular blood supply comes in and branches to form a capillary bed. And then that's connected into the portal vessel that goes to the anterior pituitary. And then you have another one that goes to the general blood circulation. So that means that the blood can carry things from the hypothalamus directly to the anterior pituitary. Things don't go out into the general circulation, go all the way around, and then hit the pituitary. Things are carried directly from one to the other. And the hormones that are carried directly, the signal molecules, are referred to as releasing factors or releasing hormones. So they're called something RH or something RF. Now, they travel then through the blood, through this portovesicle, to the anterior pituitary. But how do hormones get to the posterior pituitary? The difference there, if you look at your picture, is that the axons of the nerves go all the way down into the posterior pituitary. So what the posterior pituitary really is the nerve endings of the hypothalamus. Now, how does a chemical get released here? The chemical, which is a peptide, has to be made up here in the cell body. But then the peptide has to get carried all the way down this axon to the nerve ending before it can be released. Remember, microtubules acting as railroad tracks. So the proteins that are made in the cell bodies in the hypothalamus are put into vesicles, and the vesicles are carried all the way down the axons. And then at the terminal of the axon, the vesicle releases the material into the blood. And here you have the usual capillary bed and to the general circulation. Now, just look very briefly at the top of the picture. So we're saying this connection then, the portal vessel belongs over here. And it's a nerve connection, just the neuron itself, that stretches from the hypothalamus to the posterior pituitary. And you see that there are two major hormones released here, oxytocin and vasopressin. Now, let me just fill in this piece and we'll wrap it up for today. We talked earlier about thyroid hormone, TH, TSH, and TRH. Somebody asked me, was TRH the same as TSH? Well, no. The what usually works here is the anterior pituitary secretes other hormones. These are the so-called tropic hormones. There are multiple releasing factors, and each one leads to the release of the appropriate tropic hormone. And then it goes to its target gland, and it releases a hormone. And then that goes to the target somatic cell, and something happens. So the case we talked about before with TH, TSH, and TRH, how does it fit in here? If this is the thyroid gland, the hormone it releases is TH, or thyrotropin. The tropic hormone is TSH, thyroid-stimulating hormone for the gland, or thyrotropin. And what do you call the thing up here? The thing from the hypothalamus that tells the anterior pituitary to make thyrotropin, that's called TRH, for thyrotropic releasing hormone. And now you understand why they call them TRH, TSH, and TH. So you have the releasing hormone, tells the anterior pituitary to release the tropic hormone, which stimulates the gland to make the hormone. And as you can see, there are three parallel cases here of that. And the anterior pituitary also makes what we call other hormones. Now let me just say before I stop that the good thing about this picture is, except for this, there are only two more. There are only two other boxes on the right, the adrenal medulla and the pancreas, and when you put them in, you got all the major glands and all the major hormones. And we'll fill in the rest of this, so bring it back next time. Now I should make an announcement that today is the last day to change your registration. And depending on what part of the university is in, you can drop it, you can W it, you can pass-fail it, or you can scream. So if you have any questions about whether you should do anything and you want to come talk to me today, during my regular office hours, I'll probably be answering questions about the material, but I'll be in my office this afternoon if anyone has any questions. Now, the question is, did I get the tape recorder to work?
I was wondering when you were mentioning the different drugs to stop the TPR.
Just 1 second. Okay.